Welcome to Loading Dock Talks, where all the juiciest conversations happen. I'm Chef Prithi Mistry. Every episode, I talk to my favorite food folks about their lives, food, and social justice, and we do a little shit talking too. So there was an Eater article that came out about all of these women and BIPOC-owned restaurant businesses that were supposed to get money from the SBA, from the Small Business Administration, because they had been prioritized. And then these, like, you know, right-wing guys decided to sue the SBA and say that this prioritization of women and BIPOC folks was discriminating against white men. And so then the SBA froze all the money that they promised in, like, specific amounts in letters and emails that they promised all of these people. They all of a sudden are like, oh, no, sorry, we can't do it. And so I just had retweeted the article in Eater and said something real simple, basic about, like, where are chef heroes now? Like, sort of like, well, what are they going to do now? I just wrote, like, Thomas question mark, Tom question mark, Guy question mark, Tom Colicchio quote tweet. So he retweets my tweet and then answers my question. The way he answers it was very arrogant of, like, oh, if you're talking about this guy, I'm the guy that pat myself on the back. Let me just tell you all the great things I've done. That was the response. And I immediately was like, oh, fuck. Like, the guy's got, like, literally almost a million followers. Like, 920,000 something followers. I have, like, 6,000. Which, you know, I did the math, is, like, less than 1%, 0.006% of the amount of followers he has. And to me, that's, like, that's a power play. And so for him to just be all innocent, like, oh, I'm just answering your question, doesn't really get at what I'm saying. It's not about what he's saying. It's about how he's saying it. And essentially, by responding to me and taking it out of my timeline thread and putting it in his own, he's engaging all of his followers, almost a million people. And he's also taking a position that is somewhat defensive. It was defensive. It was like, oh, well, if this is the Tom you're talking about, then let me tell you how great I am. And this is all the stuff I've done. Not like, hey, Prithi, I hear what you're saying. I think it's really frustrating too. You know, I actually was one of the people that fought for this prioritization. And now it's sort of, you know, one step forward, two steps back. But it came from a place that wasn't like, hey, we're on the same team. But instead weaponizing a massive followership of almost a million people, and basically sort of saying, hey, look at this person. They're saying bad things about me and I'm such a great guy. And when you take almost a million of people who are your fans and say, big reminder, I'm a great guy, as opposed to what this person's trying to say about me, it's weaponizing your followership, right? Yeah. And so, you know, I immediately deleted that tweet, the original tweet, and replied and was just like, this is not an appropriate way for you to respond. And then he just kept doing it. It was really frustrating. And, you know, and then there's all these people who don't know anything about me going on there saying all this stupid shit, like, oh, I'm just attention seeking. And, oh, I'm probably still mad about Top Chef and stuff like that. Like, can you believe that? And so then, at the urging of Chef Eric Rivera from Seattle, because he actually had to do the same thing however many months ago, because I guess Eric and Tom had a lot of arguments around the IRC and how aid was being handled and what the leadership looked like, etc. And I guess he also was basically doing the same kind of thing to Eric. And so Eric was like, yeah, you just got to block that, you know, jerk. I think Eric used a more egregious word, you know, and I was like, okay, I trust Eric. If he's telling me that there's no winning with this guy, and it wasn't even about winning, it was just more like getting through. So then I finally block him and I'm like, okay, I can just let this whole fucking thing go that I never ever wanted to begin with. I mean, Anne was like, can we please stop talking about this? So Friday morning, I woke up to find out that Top Chef crowned a winner on Thursday night. And apparently the chef that they picked, this Gabe guy, is a known sexual harasser. He was fired from his job in December. And what's the date? Oh, it's July. So 7 months since he was fired for harassment. And all of the people at Top Chef, Tom, Padma, Gail, Magical Elves, Bravo, NBC Universal, nobody thought maybe this was a bad idea and maybe we should do something different. So, wow. Yeah, Tom harassed me for 2 days, for like 48 hours, until I felt like I just was so frustrated I had to block him. And then I came to find out that he was part of making this really poor decision. So, I don't think he has any real concept of the type of trauma and harm that this form of leadership, whether you're engaging in it yourself or you're just turning a blind eye to it existing, and then to this egregious level of like rewarding this person when you know this and saying that basically, once again, this fucked up idea that somehow the food is the most important thing. And it doesn't matter how the employees are treated or any of those other aspects. The original tweet comes from what has transpired in the last year and a half since the pandemic started in March of last year. And that is that all of these, very moneyed, networked, resourced chefs, pretty much all white men, sort of decided that they're the leaders and most people acquiesced and that they're going to fix it for everybody. Daddy's going to go take care of it. Don't you worry your pretty little head. And this, I think Eric was much more vocal with Tom last year until he blocked him because of exactly this. And that is that just because you've done all these things and you believe that you're doing all of this good doesn't mean that no one has the right to question you or criticize you. Because to me, one of my responses to Tom was also like if you really cared so much about the concerns of BIPOC and women, of which I'm both, like, why are you using your rich white male power to be a jerk to me? And at the same time saying, you're the savior of everybody. Like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, show some fucking humility, dude. Like, put it in check. Like, if you have that much power, you need to know how to wield it. They're executive producers. Padma has already made a statement, as weak sauce as it was, she made a statement. So if she can make a statement, so could Tom, and not saying a goddamn word, it's pathetic, it's cowardly, and it's basically upholding this sexist system. If it had gone under the radar, and they clearly knew, that also means that they were absolutely willing to award and reward a known sexual harasser, and all they cared about was whether they were going to get like called out or not, but not that maybe it's really not okay to reward a sexual harasser. I put this on Twitter. I'll say it again. A lot of people seem to agree. Like, it's the fucking, like, use the like basic ass after school special approach, yo. You know what I'm talking about? When you'd watch that one serious like sitcom on Family Ties where it turns out the uncle's an alcoholic, and then at the end they would stop and they'd be like, alcoholism is a problem in our, you know, country, blah, blah, blah. If you or anyone you know, right? Like, they really could have done that. They could have showed the entire thing with that sexual harasser winning. And then they didn't have to fly everybody back or reshoot a finale or anything. They could have just cut to Tom and Padma sitting in, like, you know, powerful director's chairs with the black backdrop, like, serious, and just be like, hey, this is what we found out after we taped it. Lie, but okay. This is a massive problem in our industry. Like, the fact that they had an opportunity. They had an opportunity to bring this really huge, really prevalent issue, problem, cancer in our industry, and really like talk about it seriously and take it seriously. And it kind of makes me emotional even saying it, because they had the power, they had the opportunity. You know, Tom, Padma, Gail, Magical Elves, all those producers, like, they have so much money. They have so much power. They have so many resources. Like, Tom could have been a big fucking feminist hero if they had made that decision. So, I mean, to me, it's also like, why are you people so fucking stupid that you would squander an opportunity to get all the pats on the back? You know, like, you want to say that you're such good people and you're such fucking humanitarians and all this stuff, but when you're actually presented with a clear opportunity, you fuck it up, because you're not really humanitarians. You're humanitarians when it's convenient. Just the squandered opportunity is just so ridiculous, and it just kind of shows people more than anything about how much they don't really care. This week, we are talking to Eric Rivera, owner and chef of Otto Restaurant in Seattle. I still haven't met Eric in real life, but we met online, specifically on Twitter, last year at the beginning of the pandemic, when all hell was breaking loose for restaurants around the country and everyone had something to say. What really impressed me was at the same time that Eric was one of the more vocal criticizers of some of these celebrity chefs whose personal net worth was in the multi-millions, he also seemed to be one of the masters of the chef pivot and very quickly went about creating so many different types of opportunities and experiences to keep his staff employed and to create different experiences for his customers. As we usually do with every episode, we're going to start by talking a little bit about little Eric Rivera at 5 years old.
My parents are Puerto Rican. I was the first person in my family that was born over here. And so, you know, there was this big loss in translation kind of thing of growing up in a small town in Washington State that's predominantly white. And having to kind of work within that, understand who those people are, what they are, what the neighbors are, who are the friends, and essentially learn an entire new culture that wasn't mine. And also sounding like them when my parents don't. None of anybody else in my family does. And basically learning how to speak English like this by watching TV and having people stick me in front of that. That's kind of been how I've learned everything. So with food stuff, my grandparents moved over here when I was born until I was about 7 years old. And so my grandpa cooked, my grandma didn't. He treated her like his princess. He didn't want her to do household chores. He didn't want her to do like anything. He was like, I got it. I'll take out the trash. I'll clean the house. I'll whatever. He's like, you just be like my, you know, queen type person. So he would cook like three, four meals a day. It was all him. And so when my parents both worked, my dad was military and then my mom was a bank teller. Like I would help him cook. I would help him like prepare breakfast, lunch and dinner for everybody. And so that's kind of like, I would spend my whole day cooking, watching soap operas in English and in Spanish.
My grandma learned how to speak English from watching soap operas.
Yeah. I mean, and that was part of it. That and like game shows. So that's why I'm a little bit more like amped
Price
up.
Is Right.
Price is Right. Like I see me going, that's all from me. Like legitimately watching like that and Sesame Street and Muppet Show and all that kind of shit. It's like really amped up. Really showy. That's where my stupid nature comes from, I guess.
You think it's just that, or you think there's also, I mean, tell me about like your parents and your grandparents. Like, is there a bit of that kind of performative nature in their, personalities as well?
My grandpa, yes. Like he was very like, all right, we're going to party. All right, it's like, I'm making dinner. I'm going to drink a beer. You're going to drink a beer. You know, and I'm like 5 years old. You know, it's like one of those things. It's part of our culture. Just to kind of like, you're at home. Fuck it. There's no rules here. We're having a good time. My mom's very outgoing. My dad isn't. Mm-hmm. So I got a lot of the stuff from both of them. I can be a curmudgeon, very much so. And I could not want to talk to anybody for months at a time. But also if I'm out and about and I need to, then I can, you know, kind of flip the switch.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting. You know, 9 times out of 10, I'd rather just be like the curmudgeon, playing video games and kind of like hiding from people.
So what were some of the things that your grandfather and you cooked together?
Everything. I mean, he taught me how to cook in a microwave, which is the dopest shit ever. You know, rice in a microwave, everything. And then, you know, bigger batch stuff for like holidays and ovens and stovetops and everything, pork, fish, you know, raw stuff to cook things. It like really the whole spectrum of like Puerto Rican cuisine all the way into some like fusion-y, that wasn't a term then. Now, fusion-y stuff that was like, hey, here's some American thing that we're going to apply, you know, Puerto Rican flavors to. It was never like, this is Puerto Rican food. It was like, let's just take the flavors that we have and put them into something else.
Yeah. It was just a natural progression of like cultures like that you're around. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I feel that way about a lot of the things that when, I mean, I really am not a fan of the word fusion, although I don't get like riled up when people use it. But like, for me, it's sort of like, I just use the same logic in my food that any other chef would. So these are the things that are around me. And I think about how those things work together in a particular dish and what it brings to a dish. And yeah, I mean, it's really, it's just... I mean, it's all global too, right? Like, you know, like everybody's watching something somewhere and be going, oh, how could I do that with what this is?
Yep. I went on this thing for a while, was like reverse colonization through cuisine. And it was basically me as a Puerto Rican person going to different parts of the world and applying my flavors to their food.
You did this in the restaurant, like a menu?
I didn't tell anybody that that's what I was doing. So I was doing it with all the cuisines that people see as like the standards of cuisine.
Right.
So like French food and Italian cuisine and Spanish cuisine. And I was like kind of like checking them off in my head. And then that's what kind of let me go down the path of like really fancy high-end pasta. And then applying my flavors to that and going like, see, it's that much more flavored.
So tell me what that looks like. What does that look like on a plate?
It would look exactly the same, but it would taste different because it has Puerto Rican flavors on top of it or worked into it.
My second restaurant was a cafe that the main thing we did there was Indian pizza, but then it was a cafe. So we'd also have like turmeric fucking lattes and shit. And so we used to call it, our joke was like hashtag colonize the colonizer. And basically like, we're going to make all the things that they make, but we're going to make them yummier with Indian flavors. And you're not going to be mad about paying $24 for a pizza because you're used to paying $24 for a pizza.
Exactly.
As opposed to like the same things deconstructed as like a curry and naan, you're like, fuck you, $24.
Yeah. I mean, like really good quality rice can cost as much, if not more than, you know, dried pasta, but I can charge $24 for a bowl of pasta. To me, when I approach something like an Italian cuisine and I'm looking at like a dish, like a cacio e pepe, for example, really something super simple, I'm looking at the spices worked into that. And most of the times just like black pepper. So I'm looking at something like that and going, okay, so what if I take the rest of it? I make the pasta, then I have the rest of the sauce and I just put some like adobo or sazon in there. Or I take something else and go like, what else can we do in place of pepper? What else can we do in place of, you know, the shape of the pasta? Would it work better if we did something else? What if it, you know, what if it was a different type of cheese than just Parmesan or, you know, anything else? You know, it could be like a cheese from Puerto Rico. Could it be like something that acts like a cheese from Puerto Rico since I'm all the way in Seattle? You know, and so then it starts to really like pick and pull at it. But I wouldn't call it cacio e pepe. I'd call it cacio e papi. Cause that's funny. Cause that's, cause that's funny to me.
Well, and it's fun. It's also like you're claiming it in a way, right? You're sort of like, and,
yeah, just like temporarily. I'm not building a whole concept off of it. Like it's not like some like white dude who's going to see like birria tacos on YouTube and then like have a money from somebody that can have them have a place, you know, for like 2 or 3 years until the trend dies down. This is very different. This is like, hey, cool. This is awesome. I could do this. Hi, how you try? Here's a conversation piece, but there's nothing in the way of me, you know, erecting entire concept and get, you know, wanting to get millions of dollars to make a fucking restaurant built around it. That's not it for me.
Do you feel like it's because you always want to keep moving on to like more things that are interesting to you? Like you want to keep creating new stuff and like, you're not just going to like crank out the same thing.
Because what's fun for me is more of that improvisation of it rather than just doing the same thing 3,000 times. I've seen great artists portrayed in museums and they all have their different periods that makes them an awesome artist, right? It's pretty rare that you see an artist that paints the same exact thing over and over and over and gets obscenely like successful of it.
Yeah.
So to me, I'm like, oh, why don't I apply something like that? And we create different dishes that could not art because that sounds douchey, but different evolutions of things that we're working on that can always change in a moment's notice. And that's what keeps me able to be flexible.
Was this something you feel like was always, you know, to get back a little bit to your younger Eric, like when you were 10, 12 years old, like, did you find it hard to focus on one thing and you wanted to like be creative and be doing a lot of different types of things? Or were there certain things you were really all about?
No, I've always been like that. It's always been like, here's this cool thing that I like. Is this a long-term, short-term, you know, or whatever kind of process? And then what's auxiliary stuff? And then what's on the horizon? And then managing all of that.
But how did that manifest for you when you were younger? Like, and before you'd like fully understood, this is how I am and this is just how I operate, when you're just sort of like that young person kind of with all this bubbling out of them?
Yeah, it was a good thing and a bad thing. A lot of times it was a bad thing because I would be put in situations where like my dad was military, so we moved around a lot. So it's always having to reintroduce yourself every year or two, you know, going to
different
schools.
Did you like that? Or?
No.
Yeah.
No, there was never a stability in it. So the stability had to be within my direct family and myself. So I essentially had to create my own stability and be like, here's who I have to be. Just make yourself happy somewhat or be depressed or whatever. But like, there's not going to be a lot of people here that you can depend on to help push you around, you know? And so when I was a little kid, it was always like, you know, oh, my parents want me to be a doctor or an attorney. I want to be an astronaut, a baseball player, you know, magician.
It's the immigrant dream.
Yeah. I
want to. Your parents want you to be a doctor or a lawyer, and you want to be a poet.
I want to make music. I want to play trumpet. I want to, you know, I want to sing. I want to dance. I want to be on a comedy show, you know, all this kind of shit. And I practice all of that stuff. I mean, we got a VHS camcorder, and I was like, reenacting like I was the host of Masterpiece Theater, and I'd like do the intro over and over. I'm like, hello, my name's Eric. Welcome to Masterpiece Theater. And I'm like, I was like a fucking awesome 4 or 5 year old kid. And then you watch something like The Simpsons, and I started to see like Hank Azaria, where it's like this one person who's doing all these voices. And it's like, I wonder if I could do all those voices, you know? And I started practicing like all these different voices. So it's like always this constant, like, oh man, that's awesome. You know, that's cool.
And then some of us are lucky enough to realize that the kid stuff is really fun and we get to come back to it and own it and wear Bugs Bunny t-shirts and be on kids shows and, you know, and not poo-poo kids shows.
No, I mean, that's exactly what I... So going back to pasta and the iterations of it. So my first pasta that I ever ate was like the little kid pasta, alphabet soup, you know, SpaghettiOs and shit like that in cans and all these fun shapes. And, you know, so I've gotten to the point now where, you know, later this week I have new pasta dyes coming and they're like bat and spider shapes. Because I want
to. You made your own pasta? Are we on a podcast and you made your own pasta shape?
Yes, I'm now seeking investors. Please give me $2 million right now. And I want to be in the New York Times for this shit.
Okay, but I get one of the million because it's my podcast.
Well, I didn't say we weren't going to split it. I was going to be nice about it.
All right.
I know. I was like, this is the best sponsorship deal of your lifetime. No, I'm just kidding. Here's $1 million. No, but it's like, I want to do like the alphabet soup stuff. I don't want to do whatever, but.
That sounds awesome. I want grown up alphabet soup.
That's kind of what I want to go for. Because I think a lot of it has been stripped from being like everyday Italian food to like serving people to then take it to the next level by a bunch of people who know that they can charge a lot for a little. And it's become this thing where like, oh my God, the hand cut pappardelle, we're going to do this with truffles. And it's a bump at French Laundry for $175. You're like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, no, it's not that. And it's not worth that much. So let's just go back a couple steps, and I want to make that fun for people. I want to do our pasta, which is dope, you know, with bat shapes and spider shapes and letters and stupid shit.
Nice.
Because I think that's fun, and it should be that way. And you know, I'm not going to charge $25 for it unless somebody really wants me to, but you know, we'll see.
I also am a big fan of the playfulness. One thing I think that's interesting is how when some of us BIPOC chefs do like playful things, it's sort of seen as amateurish. But when like fine dining chefs do things, it's like sort of fawned over in this like, oh, they're so creative. They're delving deep into their childhood and oh, they're so whimsical.
Yeah.
But you know, I put 7 garnishes on a slider. and it's still a slider. You can still eat it in 4 bites.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's a damn good sandwich.
I mean, I've been part of the teams that did the plating on the food, you know, the food on plates thing rolled out at Alinea, you know, I was part of the team that helped make the balloon float. You know, I've done that stuff before, but I've also had the filter in my head of if you look at it in a very plain black and white way, all we're doing is like rolling out of a mat on a table and just finger painting.
The thing that frustrates me a lot of times is that a lot of chefs take themselves and restaurateurs take themselves way too seriously. And that at the end of the day, like we're not like brain surgeons. We're like making food.
No.
but I'm curious, you mentioned Alinea and you were part of that. What, and you worked in finance, is that right? Finance or tech?
Previous before I was in business and finance and that kind of stuff.
Okay. And what brought you into food?
The last recession.
Okay.
I basically said I want to do something that I like doing. I knew kind of how to cook, meaning like at home. And that always made me happy. And I was super depressed of being like a 26-year-old kid that had to close my business in 3 different states and hand back keys to my house and turn back keys to a car and basically start from scratch living in like a basement and doing that whole thing that I said, at least if I pursue this and I have to like live in my car again, at least I can make some dope top ramen. And that's that's exactly what led to me going into this industry.
So where did you start? What was your like, okay, this is what I'm going to do to get started in this space?
I started cooking in my house. I started taking pictures of my food with some piece of shit digital camera. And then like Blogspot and all these kinds of things came on. So I started a cooking blog and I started posting on it. In like my first year, I had like 1,200 posts, which is insane. They weren't good. They were terrible. I didn't write very well. I still don't. The pictures were atrocious, but I just wanted as a way to look back at as can I evolve this? And it started to look like it. And I was, and it made me happy. I got to a point that one of my friends came to me. He's like, hey, man, like, what the fuck are you doing? I don't know if this is going to pan out for you. And why don't you look at like go cook at a restaurant? So I was like, oh, sure. You know, I don't even know how to do that. So I took my little resume. I addressed who the you know biggest and best chefs and restaurants in Seattle were. And I started knocking on doors with my little resume. And nobody called me back.
And then?
I said, fuck this shit. I got to figure something else. And I went into culinary school. I just said, I have no other choice. Like, I got to get in restaurants. My first week that I was there, I went to one of my teachers and she was like, you know, what do you want to do? I was like, it's this. And she goes, let me look at your resume. And then she deleted everything off of it and just put culinary student. And she goes, go try to find a job now. Yep. Sure enough, man. That next fucking day, I went back to the restaurant and got a job as a prep cook.
And then where did you go from there?
I staged at Noma. And then I came back, graduated. And then I worked in a seafood place here in Seattle as a sous chef. Mm-hmm. I got promoted to sous chef before I graduated. So that was, I was like running a million miles an hour.
Yeah. So you ended up at Alenia.
Mm-hmm.
Was that, I'm assuming, intentional?
Yeah. I do a lot of research on a lot of things that I'm working on, and it gets mm-hmm. very in-depth. It's never by accident, especially with something like that. It was very direct about where I want to go. I started working there in a hybrid position that was like 1 foot out the door of the restaurant, 1 foot in the door with the restaurant. It graduated from being just to be working at Alenia, for working for the whole group, to working on side projects, to, you know, anytime Chef would travel, I would travel with him. If there was a big event, like a food and wine thing, I was like part of the team that would go help set everything up and then do the whole thing and mm-hmm. then prep everything. And then, you know, there's a time we did like a charity event in Australia with like Thomas Keller and all this stuff. Like I was in the mix. I've met all the chefs. I've met all the people. I've done all, you know, every single thing in this industry on that level. Mm-hmm. I've seen it. So that for me, it was them tapping into my flexibility. And I think this is the first, it was the first time that anybody actually like really let me go without stopping me. Mm-hmm. And that's when I finally knew, I was like, okay, I'm going to package this shit up and to a point, and then I'm going to stop it and go do it for myself.
That's amazing. I mean, it sounds like you were able to like be your full self and really like grow in this role.
Yeah. I knew that I could do it because I was working directly with Chef, and I was working directly with Nick, and I was working with directly all of the highest teams. I wasn't mm-hmm. prepping a fucking station. I wasn't a commis. I knew I was finally in a different place when I had my own office that was above the aviary. And like, I would just was there by myself working on projects for like weeks and months on end, you know? And it was like future menus of next or different ideas that Chef had, or he was, you know, texting mm-hmm. me from halfway around the world going like, hey man, what do we think about this? Or sending me a picture like, hey, what is this ingredient? What can we get? How do we do this? How do we source it? How do we get it? And I'm like, give me a couple of days, I'll figure it out. You know, and that was like this whole full speed thing. But I knew that if I could work with those people and hang with them, then mm-hmm. I could hang with anybody.
I first met Eric on Twitter like at the beginning of the pandemic, because there was a lot going on with the Independent Restaurant Coalition, the IRC, and people like Tom Colicchio and David Chang taking these sort of paternalistic leadership roles and saying that this is what's going on and they're in charge. And Eric was very quick to question their assumed leadership, and that intrigued me. And so, you know, there was Eric being very skeptical and vocal, publicly vocal. I just assume that this has kind of always been his MO. What I actually came to find out in this next segment is that he knows and understands the fine dining industry quite intimately, because he's very much involved in it and considers, or maybe in some cases considered, I don't know, a lot of those folks his friends, definitely colleagues. And it was really this sort of, you know, COVID pulling the curtain back that shifted his perspective. And I think that that's true for a lot of people. So I really wanted to talk to Eric about his journey from being really embedded in this community, this fine dining community, to now, a year later, year and a half later, really being seen as one of the more public and vocal critics of a lot of people in the fine dining industry. What do you feel like is something that you learned? What is something new that you feel like you learned about yourself through the last year of the pandemic?
That I didn't need to filter myself so much.
Hmm.
I think for years, platforms or social media stuff, like I never used to say anything underneath them. I would just post a picture or like react to something and just be like, oh, that's awful. You know, mm-hmm. because I never felt like the things I said mattered for anyone. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think the way it was portrayed in my head, it's like the only people that are going to be listened to are like famous people or rich people. So if I had to say something or I am saying something, like, who fucking cares?
If you pop off enough, it'll make you slightly famous.
I don't know. I mean, that's to me, like, that's why I don't have the association or like the want for that. Like, there's nothing with anything that I say on social media or whatever else that's like, I want something out of it. Other than yeah. like people who are being affected to put the eyes on them and, mm-hmm. and like actually fucking listen to them. And if it involves me telling you to go fuck yourself and 10 other people go, God damn, that guy just told that other person to go fuck himself. And I'm like, exactly. And I'll do it to you too. So anyway, the 9 of you that are left now, mm-hmm. go and help that other person, you know? So that's kind of where I've realized that over the past yeah. year and a half. And the only reason I realized that is because I can see the back end analytics on Twitter and I see how many people like look at my shit and read it. And I'm like, that's a lot of people.
Do you feel like you've probably, or do you know for a fact that you have lost some friends or gained some enemies through mm-hmm. being less filtered?
Yeah. I've pretty much been excommunicated from fine dining and mm-hmm. most restaurants, but it doesn't matter. I know how to make their food. So it's not like I'm missing out on something. it's different for me. Like I don't need to go back to those places to go back and experience something that's not good for a lot of people. Right.
Yeah.
That's not okay for me. Like, I'm not going to go to French Laundry next week. I don't give a shit about that anymore. They're dead to me. So in my mind, it's, if I have people that are paying attention to what the fuck I'm saying, mm-hmm. there's a different point of view that I would like to push forward. And so that's why, like, when I like your stuff and I retweet your stuff or I comment and say like some shit to like stoke the fire a little bit more on things you're saying, or just to highlight it, it's not me like trying to jump on your shit. It's me going like, no, this is right. This is how people should be doing this in this industry. Mm-hmm. More people need to see yeah. this. And yeah. that's all I want. That's literally all I want. And like, I made a rule over this past year of like, I'm not going to retweet or comment or talk to or like whatever the mediocre white bullshit food. Like, I'm going to go out of my way to find other people who are like, that don't have the platforms that want to get it. And so that's where I'm on my side. I'm like, oh yeah, no, follow this person or here's, you know, retweet this person. It's literally the least I can fucking do because I don't have the money to give these right. people to push them in a platform forward. Like, I really don't. And so, you know, if I can do it and they get a, you know, a deal out of it, or if they have a story that's written about them or whatever, awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I feel similar. I feel like that's the way that I've used my and wanted to use my platform for the many years that I've been lucky enough to have a lot of journalists ask my opinion about things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That I've always used that to, you know, hype up people who I think deserve. And I appreciate that from you as well, because I think that, you know, just getting your perspective, especially someone who's been in the fine dining world and really knows a lot about a lot of the players or just what those environments can be like, it's really great to get your insight, both on Twitter and today and in different panels and things you've been a part of. Your perspective is unique and you have a really great way of, as I was just saying, like connecting the dots and moving at this sort of pace that is challenging for a lot of people. I know that it probably for you it feels like whatever, this is just how I am, but for a lot of people they probably read a lot of the things that you say and are like, oh wow, I get it, in ways that they might not have arrived mm-hmm. there that quickly mm-hmm. or at all on their own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very strange. It feels strange because even when I made the decision to close our restaurant, even before we were told to mm-hmm. People were like, why would you do that? And I'm like, no, I don't think you understand how irresponsible everybody fucking is. Mm-hmm. I was like, I've been in restaurants and I've done this stuff and I've actually looked around, you know, and seen people doing really dumb stuff to tell you that we're going to be dealing with this for a long time. And anybody who's going to say anything otherwise is full of shit. And this is more than just food now. This is a full-on health pandemic
Yeah.
People are going to die. Yeah. And that's more important than your fucking food that you can make yourself, even if you are these big name chefs. And that's what I value more for other people is their health and safety. They just really need to like understand that it's not okay to have one person dead from this. And it's also not okay to have 600,000 plus people dead from this. And it's also not good to profit off of other cultures and cuisines that are going and are being affected by this a lot more than even we are, and continuing and grabbing that torch and moving forward. You know, like the guy you were torching in Portland, that was doing Indian cuisine.
Yeah.
And hadn't said anything. And you know, I don't think he still has. No, and they won't, because you don't have to. They're not held accountable to that. Exactly. But as long as it's out there and somebody's saying, hey, look, this guy's an asshole. Here's this pandemic humanitarian process that's happening in India. They're being affected by it more than anybody else right now. And you're going to carry on like, hey, guys, we're doing this thing and blah, blah, blah. Or we're going to donate proceeds, which they didn't even do that shit anyway. But it's still just like, you've benefited more from anyone else than if you benefit more from anybody else, then you should be the first in line to help.
Exactly. You know?
And that's the kind of thing that I see when you say it. I'm like, fuck, man, what's wrong with this guy? Fuck that guy. You know? I like seeing that. It's not to just be like the what's today's Twitter daily, like dumpster fire. It's, hey, I think there's a lot of things out there all the time in this industry where it just gets swept underneath because, oh, we're this, you know, established, been here long enough. This goes back to like right at the beginning of our conversation of the seniority of it. Well, how much seniority do they get to have before they just have to be blind to the world? And that's what's really happened over this last year and a half, is where those people that are like that don't have that option anymore.
So, you know, I've been over here for a while.
Yeah.
And they're like, fuck these guys, please. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, like, where's the sort of line? Because I think that, you know, someone could look at a lot of the things that you and I and a lot of other folks sort of in our cohort, if you will, talk about, you know, oh, these menus are so expensive and it's ridiculous and half their staff are unpaid and blah, blah, blah. But then on the other hand, we're also like, people need to pay more for restaurant food.
Yeah.
It's, you know, this is how you get a living wage for your hourly staff. Where do you feel like your food and offerings fit into that? I know you have a lot of different diverse offerings.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious to hear about both the more accessible things that are within some of your products and stuff. And then, you know, like I see you have like a $1,000 menu for two.
Mm-hmm.
Like, tell me about sort of how you find the balance in doing all of that work and feeling like you're doing the good work and not the sort of willows in hump, not that you're, you know, all that stuff, all the other stuff, but just, you know, this whole sort of criticism of these extremely expensive menus for a very small group of people.
Sure. I think there's a point of entry to all of it. And I think within my space and in my business, that point of entry is very different all the way across. I started this off in my apartment 3 years ago by doing two people at a time. I pitched people. I talked to investors. I talked to everybody. I tried to get loans. Nobody had given nothing. So I was like, oh, I have to pay at least rent in my apartment. So I sold, you know, a 12-course tasting menu in my apartment for two people. That's the only seats I had. So that has gone through everything from, you know, pop-ups around the city, you know, doing $5 bowls of pork and rice to, you know, pasta nights to hot dog nights to, you know, more than 200 different programming things over the last year and a half during the pandemic at all price points, even free. So for me, it's all about what I can do now. Now that I have the vaccine, that changed things for me. But I also have to do things differently and operate differently going into business. So that's why you see the $1,000 thing. There's two by two that come in a night for that. So it's four people a night that I'm serving, going back to my original thing. And that's 12 courses with wine included. And we don't do tips here. So that's also included in that too. And it's just four people a night. And then I have in this area that I'm sitting in right now, we do 6x6. And so it's an occupancy where I had before at 50. Taking it down to, what is that, four plus 16 people a night. and going like, well, if I only have to do that, that's for a reason, because I don't want a lot of people bopping around here. I still want to keep everybody and maintain them to be safe and follow safety protocols, with the addition of freeing up and opening up the space to them. So I have the dining room segmented for the people that are six people, all the way for the people that are two, that are far enough away. So that comes at a little bit of a premium. It's still, I should be charging more, to be honest. But I feel like it's fair in my mind to not go that way, because I don't want it to be like Saison pre-pandemic and be more expensive than that, because that seems like I'm not doing that. It's not okay. Mm-hmm. But I want people to see, and I've always been this clear with people, like I want them to see the evolution as we go back into something that could open up to, hey, if we end up going from two seats to four seats, guess what? The price drops. If we end up going from four seats to six seats to eight seats, like we had it before, the chef's table was eight seats. And our chef's table was seven or 12 courses. Seven courses was $65. 12 courses was $105. And that was pre-pandemic. You know, so if I can get back to that, cool. If it's still something where we have to deal with things opening, closing, and all that kind of stuff, I'm okay with that. You know, that's why I built everything on occupancy level and required people to have vaccines, and I'm really a stickler for that kind of shit. I control the show here, and I make the rules.
So does everybody who... So when you say that about everyone having vaccines, you're talking about your staff, or you're talking about customers?
Mm-hmm. Everybody.
You're making sure that...
Everybody.
Everyone says that they're vaccinated?
Not
says. Do they need to show proof?
Fuck right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I check their vaccine cards like I'm checking ID. You know what I mean?
Damn.
I was like, I need to see it. If I don't see it, it's not real, get the fuck out. And I already tell them ahead of time, it's like a no refund policy. So now you're just wasting your fucking time.
I mean, one of the things I struggled with when, you know, people out here would ask me to do things, and I'm like, yeah, so I'm out here saying like, it's not cool to have $500 dinners. And now because of COVID and we can only have 10 guests,
it has to be now, $500.
And I need to get paid.
Has to be that way.
So I think it's, I'm just curious, do you feel like because you're also able to do a lot of other, you're like the king of revenue streams, I feel like, at this point.
Yeah.
Because you have those, then it's like, you know what, this is for these people. I'm just curious, I don't know. I had this idea when I was looking at all your offerings. Here's the big question.
Mm-hmm.
There's an ongoing thing, I feel like, especially as someone who's done a lot of catering and private client work, that if people you really hate and can't stand demand that you do something, that you just charge them like 3, 4, 5 times as much. And if they still say yes, then even though you can't stand them, at least you're getting fucking paid. So I wasn't sure if the two people for $1,000 was also like, if you really want this, pay the fuck up.
Mm-mm. No. I don't find any joy in cooking or making things happen for people I don't like. Yeah. I've been in menus at my chef's counter at my restaurant with people who clearly did not want to be there or were thinking it was going to be something else. I've cut the menu short. I've refunded them on the spot with my phone in front of them. I'm like, check your email. I refunded you. This is like a bad date. If you want me to make a reservation for you somewhere else, or call another chef or call another restaurant, I will Uber you. I will pay for that, but it's not working.
You've done that before?
Yes.
What's the response? I'm just curious.
Pissed off at first. And then I get an email the next day or two going like, fuck, we're going to try it again. I was having a bad day, blah, 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 blah. That was more us than you. And I'm like, I'm not blaming you guys. I'm not blaming anyone, but it can't be like that. It cannot be like that. It's not okay. Or I've had someone who a week later has emailed me back and said, hey, your wine pairing sucked. This sucked. That sucked. And I go, that's fair. How much of that do you want back? And they're like, what? How much of that do you want me to refund you? Say it. A little bit? All of it? Or are we just talking here? And they go, that's strange. And I go, no, I'm serious. Because here's what's going to happen. You're going to see that as a gesture that's for real, because it is. Mm-hmm. Or you're going to realize how much a fucking whiner you are and stop wasting my fucking time. And they're going to be like, I just wanted to get out of my system. Get a fucking therapist and leave me alone.
Yeah, you know what I mean? You're totally right. Yeah. I had these guests once that were so rude. We were like literally playing A Tribe Called Quest in the restaurant, and they kept saying that we were playing garbage music.
God. And so then we changed it to Lil Wayne. And they were like clearly being rude specifically to the women of color who were working the front of the house. I had one of my servers was a older gay white man, and whenever he would go to the table, they'd be super nice and sweet. And so finally I went over to the table, and of course I had to be like, hi, and they looked at me blankly, and I was like, I'm the owner. And they launched in, you know, because they're like, who's this kid with this flat brim hat and like mohawk? And then they launch into their whole thing about how we're so awful and this is garbage music and da 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 da. And, you know, I tried to be really nice, and they really were not vibing with that or seeing that I was, you know, and they just got really rude. And so finally I just was like, you're being really rude, and here's what we're going to do. I'm going to comp your entire dinner.
Yeah.
I don't need your business.
Exactly.
And I turned around and walked away and, like, said to one of my servers, like, just go ahead. And they were both just dumbfounded.
Yeah. Clear the table. Get them out of here. Let's go.
They ate the rest of their dinner.
Get the fuck out of here. And as a show of dominance, I will now eat the rest of this dinner. No, it's wild.
But there's
no
bad Yelp review because it was like, what are you going to do? Like, I paid for it. Like, you didn't pay anything for it.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Yeah. It's a crazy thing because 7, 8, 10, 12, 14 hours a day, 6, 7 days a week sometimes, it's wild. Bringing people in and whatever they're experiencing or have experienced, you don't know that. I don't know that. Right. So it could be anything. I mean, I've had people like break up in front of me. I've had people fight. I've had people get triggered by something somebody else says at another table and they're fighting. And, you know, there's always these like constant things that you're kind of like, how is it going to be today? Well, at least our shit's tight. You know, I have worked, my first job ever was at a Black Eyed Pea in Texas. Mm-hmm. It's a little chain restaurant. And I was a busboy / dishwasher. And I saw the way that people came into that place, and it was sit down service. And I saw the food was inexpensive. But I saw the way that people demanded to be waited on and served on that really made me feel like, wait, you know, my parents had taken me into not like super fine dining, but like, you know, nicer restaurants when I was a little kid, and taught me how to act and taught me how to deal with stuff. And you don't treat these people like that. You don't talk to them like that. We're going to, I'm going to show you how to tip, and you're going to write the tip line. You're going to do the math. Like, I was a little kid doing like, you know, as a kid.
Teaching you how to be a responsible adult.
Yeah.
And imagine and that your parents would do that.
Yeah. And please and thank you. And oh no, I'll take the plate myself. I know that this is your job, but I will take the plate. I'll put it over here for you. Thank you. it was all stuff like that. And then, you know, working as a server in college and doing all this different types of shit. So formulating all of that into like what I want from my own restaurant to be. I don't want to be the Cheesecake Factory that's open for everyone and all things and has a 100-page menu and whatever. That's not bad that they do it. It's just not the restaurant I want for myself. And I want that to be an extension of a solely lived experience that I can provide, rather than part of the systematic issues that are around in this industry that plop up faces without anything behind them. I want people to come to this restaurant and go like, oh, here's server A, here's server B, or here's cook A, here's cook B. And I know who they are, what they are. I follow them on Instagram. I can't tell you how many people, like my own guests, do that. Because I tell them, you should follow so-and-so. They have a fucking adorable dog. The dog is so goddamn cute. And they do art, and they do this, and they do that. You should totally follow them. If you like the, you know, the cake or whatever the fuck this person made, then you should go check out, oh my God, they make this crazy like mural art, and that's dope. It's more than that, because I've always told people, I was like, you are not coming here to stay here forever. You are not coming here to help prop up shit here. You're here for a very limited time. Steal and take as much stuff as you can that you learn here. Get the fuck out and go crush somebody on the outside. That's it. That's it.
Woo. I love that.
It's never that. I tell people, I was like, the maximum you're going to probably want to work here is like 6 months to a year.
Mm-hmm.
There's no... I can't make you the executive chef. That's me. I can't make you the chef de cuisine. That's also me. I can't make you the chef owner. Oh, hey, that's also me. You know, there's no other opportunity there. So for them, they'll get stuck. And I'm like, you're going to get stuck at the second that you feel like you're working for me. That's the second you need to fucking get out of here. Mm-hmm. And they go, really? And then we always get to that point. And I go, hey, chef, do you have a second to talk? I'm like, how long? A week? 2 weeks? A month? What are you thinking? And they're like, I just need like a week. I'm like, that's fine. Just know that when you get in there, just blow them the fuck out of the way. Like run over everybody there. And then they're going to be like, God damn, where does this person come from? Otto.
that'll be gift enough for you.
Yeah. And that's fun. It's just fun. It's good for them. It's good for them to see how I work too. Because even they go, oh shit, man, this is fucking crazy. And I'm like, no, you need to see this because this is what it looks like as a chef who wants to chase their dream, who isn't given anything to get there. Mm-hmm. And once you understand why the reasons I have to do 50 fucking thousand things, then once you get that opportunity, and if it's a better opportunity for you, you could be like, ah, man, at least I could take Sunday off now. Fuck yeah. And I'll be like, that's awesome. Good. You figured it out. Good.
Yeah. That's awesome. I love that. Speaking of fun stuff, mm-hmm. we're coming to the final segment of our chat.
Countdown.
Yeah, exactly. I have some fun questions for you. Some of them I've asked other guests. Some of them are specific for you. My first question is, you're staying at a friend's house for the weekend. What are the three cooking tools or ingredients or things you're bringing with you?
Sassone, hot sauce, and vino verde.
And all of those things available in your online store?
Except for the vino verde.
Vino verde.
But right. Just a drink because it's good.
What are your favorite beans? What's your go-to bean?
Pigeon pea, because that's a big thing for us. So it's like gandules, that's like number one. I love garbanzo beans. Mm-hmm. They're awesome.
The black garbanzo beans or the tan garbanzo beans?
Both. I like both. Yeah, I don't have garbanzo beans. They're great. And even the little green ones that you can get frozen. Those are great too.
I used to get them fresh.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't. I'm in Washington. They don't grow
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah. Summertime they come out of like Central California.
That's dope.
My staff hates me because they have to pod them all.
Yeah.
But you know, it's something to pass time. It's great for front of the house. It's great fun of the front of the house side work.
Yeah. I mean, it's
to sit there and pop these in between making drinks for somebody. Who's your favorite person to cook for?
I don't know.
What if it's not a person? You could say your dog if you want to say.
No, I don't know. I kind of challenge myself, everybody. Every time somebody comes in, mm-hmm. My cooking style is very adaptive. So I will change the menu as I go.
So would it be fair to say that your favorite person to cook for is a different new person every time?
or I have guests that actually know everything about what they like and don't like. And so when they come in, I already have their menu written in my head, and then it's just variations of that.
I know that you're a big dog fan. You mentioned mm-hmm. that's what you want to do. And now Peppercorn has joined us here.
Hi, Peppercorn.
Let's talk pet history.
Yeah.
Cats, dogs, names, mm-hmm. years.
Yeah. So we've had, growing up with cockatiels, I had cockatiel fish, pups. Turtles, mm-hmm. Had a cat named Madonna. She was adorable.
Madonna.
Yeah. After the singer. And we had dogs. We had a spaniel, long-haired chihuahua named Pito. He was adorable. He was really angry and mean. But that's pretty typical with
was
chihuahuas.
He like with everyone, like with you guys, or just with strangers?
With me, no. Everybody else, yes.
Okay.
And that was a good team. I've had border collies. I've had two border collies, and then now I have a mini Australian shepherd. Her name's Odessa.
Odessa.
Mm-hmm.
And is that who we see on Twitter so often?
Yeah. 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 She's adorable. She's a cast off from a place because she doesn't have non-traditional markings for a mini Australian shepherd. So nobody wanted her. And I was like, oh,
she's very cute. I think Odessa is very cute. I must say
she's smart.
What was your first, like, wow food memory? Like, when you were growing up, something that was different from what you had at home that your grandfather made or your family made that you were kind of, like, it blew your mind a little bit?
The first time I had empanadas in Puerto Rico. That fucking probably five or six that I can remember. I'd been there before, but that was the first time I remember. That and the pastries, because I don't like sweet at all. I never really have, except for dumb candy, right? Dumb 80s candy. I like that because it was marketed towards me properly.
Tamarind Doritos is where it ends.
Yeah. But in my adult life, I don't really go towards anything that's like sugary. But that was one of the things, like going to panaderias in Puerto Rico, that shit is dope. But empanadas in Puerto Rico is a whole different ballgame. And that's something that still sticks to me today. The other one would be going to where they do lechonetas, like the whole pig places. And seeing the variations between someone that's doing one like 10 feet away from another person who's like 40 feet away, and how they have their own like styles and shit. And that nice. To me to this day like sticks as like a holy grail like moment in food. It's cool.
That's amazing. Eric, I could talk to you forever. I feel like I'm really looking forward to the day we get to hang out. I definitely have some homies up in Seattle that I'll need to visit at some point.
Hell yeah. Awesome. Yeah, just let me know. I'm here.
All right. Thanks so much to Eric Rivera for being with us. We will link to Otto in the show notes. And thank you all for listening. You can follow Loading Doc Talks in your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear, leave a review and share it with a friend. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Chef P Mystery. And a big shout out to our pod and music production team, Copper and Heat.